Next on RadioSt.Pete.com, Peter's Proffer with Clearwater attorney Peter Tragos. The experienced lawyers at Tragos, Sartes, and Tragos discuss common legal questions, providing insight into the legal process and covering current events as they relate to the legal field.
Welcome back to another episode of Peter's Proffer here in the courtroom of current events. And we've got a good one today. We're going to talk about criminal sentencing. We did a podcast on plea negotiations and plea deals a few weeks ago. This is kind of taking the next step in the process. And we've had a lot of listener questions about who comes up with the sentence. How are the guidelines set? Is there a minimum? Is there a maximum? How does all that work? So we're going to dive into that. I'm going to have my dad and Pete on, the criminal lawyers in the firm, and they're going to really dive into it because they've done a ton of this. And we've also started a new Facebook page. It's called Peter's Proffer on Facebook. You can like it. You can subscribe or follow it. We're going to get a lot of listener questions and some discussions going on in there. If you guys have any questions or comments, we'd love to hear it. We'd also love for you to subscribe on iTunes or SoundCloud. Give us a 5-star review, post any comments you have. We love doing it. We love getting input from the listeners. Those are the most fun podcasts we have because that's what people want to hear about. And we'd love to, you know, share our expertise and get our contacts in to share their expertise in some of these interviews. Going forward, we've got some cool topics coming up. We're going to do one on vaccinations coming up with an expert, what the legalities are and some of the medical side of it. We're going to do some stuff with elections when it gets closer to that. So we just love hearing from the listeners. So anything you guys have, let us know. You can put it on social media at Tragos Law. You can find us, or you can just send me a personal email, petertragos@greeklaw.com. Okay, sentencing. This is a topic that we've been asked a lot about, and it's always in the news when somebody thinks that somebody's sentence is too harsh or not harsh enough, and people don't really know why that happened. You know, it seems like an egregious crime, and they get no jail time, quote-unquote, is what the title of the news article is, or it seems like they did nothing, and they're going to prison for 5 years. So we're going to get into why all that happens now, but to start out, we're going to do a state versus federal sentencing because it's very different. So we're going to start in the state. So Pete, why don't you tell us a little bit how it works, how sentencing works in the State Department?
Okay. The state sentencing scheme, at least in Florida, works like this. There is a score sheet that the prosecutor completes. That score sheet takes into account whatever crime you're being charged with, takes into consideration any prior criminal history you have that is scorable. And in, depending on the crime, in some instance, takes into consideration, for example, injury that a victim may have experienced, or if there's a loss amount dollar-wise, or if somebody's been, you know, in prison for some sort of aggravated felony. And there are a number of points that are added up. And the points add up to one of two things, either non-state prison or a state prison sentence. That state prison number that the score sheet provides is the technically the floor, the statutory maximum of whatever level of crime that we're talking about is going to be the maximum.
Okay, so when you go into a certain crime, is there a minimum that you can get and a maximum that you can get in state court?
Well, the way it starts out, understand that there are five categories of crimes in state court.
Right.
A third-degree felony is a maximum of 5 years. A second-degree felony, maximum of 15 years in prison. First-degree felony, 30 years. And then a life felony is life. And then you have capital offenses. We have sentencing guidelines.
Those are just the felonies because there are misdemeanors as well.
Right. Those are just the felonies because sentencing guidelines only apply to felonies.
Right. And first-degree misdemeanor, it's up to 365 days in county jail.
Right. But there are no guidelines. The judge can do whatever they want.
Right.
In the state court system under the guidelines, the most recent guidelines were passed in 1998 called the Criminal Punishment Code. And that changed the way that judges look at this because now judges, the maximum they can sentence you to is the maximum of the statute. So if it's a third-degree felony, the maximum is 5 years. A judge can sentence you up to 5 years. There is no maximum under those guidelines anymore. But there is a minimum under the guidelines. And that minimum is done by a point calculation. It's a mathematical calculation. Like Pete said, the crime you commit has a number of points. Other crimes you've committed.
Previous crimes that you've been convicted of.
They have a number of points. Victim injury.
What about previous arrests but not convictions? Do they add to your point total?
No, only convictions.
What about withholds of adjudication?
No, they do not count.
Okay.
Yeah, so it's only convictions. And then they add points for victim injury, which could be sexual battery or it could be a broken nose. That adds points.
Well, there are other enhancements as well, right? Like a battery on an elderly person versus, you know, battery on a 40-year-old, it's going to be enhanced.
Well, that enhanced penalty is a minimum mandatory prison sentence.
Okay.
Right. Though that's different than the calculation numbers.
Okay,
calculation.
So those don't have anything to do with the calculation of enhancements.
Right.
Okay.
Those enhancements come into effect, for instance, if you use a gun.
Right.
During it, you have a minimum mandatory. Minimum mandatories we haven't talked about yet.
Right.
But minimum mandatories you get regardless of what your calculation is in the sentencing guidelines.
Okay, so the sentencing guidelines actually set a minimum that corresponds with the maximum that's already in the statute.
Right. It gives you basically the range of sentencing possibilities for a particular individual.
And again, we're talking just felonies in state, which are the more serious crimes.
And understand, it used to be with the guidelines, you could get probation because you would score probation. Now there's no guarantee that you're going to score probation because the top is always that prison sentence. So people that used to score probation could still go to prison now.
Explain that a little bit more. Kind of confused me with that.
All right. Before, when you had a score that said, all right, you score below, let's say, 44 points, that used to be, that means you score non-state prison, which normally meant you got probation because that's your maximum, was that 44. Well, there's no maximum anymore. The maximum is the top prison sentence in the category of felony you're convicted in. So now, even though you may score less than 44 because you could get probation, the judge could still give you 5 years
in
prison.
That's what I'm not following. So you're saying you're scoring 44 points, which equals probation?
Could be, yes.
Okay, but that's not saying in the, I guess before this change, 44 used to be your maximum?
44 meant you was qualified for probation. The judge would give you probation.
But they could still give you up to the max back then?
Only if they found some aggravating factor that raised you above the guideline.
Okay, and now what does it take for them to give you above that?
Nothing. The judge can just feel like you want above it, and you get above it.
But don't they usually, I mean, I would think most of the time they would give some aggravating factor as to why they're going above that.
No, not always. They just feel like you deserve it for the kind of crime you did. Or
isn't that an aggravating factor?
It is, but before, the kind of crime you did could still get you probation.
Okay, let's talk about the points. You said 44 points. So let's just give an example. We don't have the guidelines book in front of us, but I'm just giving an example. Let's say it's burglary equals 15 points, and right, you have a prior burglary that gets another 10 points, and you know that's how you come up with the final score, right?
Right.
You add all that together at the end, or maybe you have two prior burglaries, right, that are 10 points each, and you know this burglary is 14 points. That's how you get to 34 points.
Or you beat somebody up while you're in the residence during the burglary, so you get victim injury points.
Right.
That would even go higher.
Or a lot of times you could even have like a resisting arrest on top. So you could have two, right, or three charges that you're pleading to. So you have a burglary that's 15 points, a resisting arrest that's 5 points, and it all just kind of stacks up to give you that final point number.
See, the
total.
The problem is sentencing guidelines were established to try to have some uniformity. Because people used to complain, look, if I sold a kilo of cocaine in Miami, I'd get a lighter sentence than if I sold a kilo of cocaine in Clearwater. And they're saying that shouldn't be.
Or if I sold a kilo of cocaine and I'm black, I could get a worse sentence than if I sold a kilo of cocaine and I'm white. Now the uniformity should help that.
That's what it was supposed to do.
Right. Okay. And you don't think that it's done that?
It hasn't, because now what they've done is, with all this law and order stuff, now they've capped how low you can go on a sentence.
So everybody lost, basically.
Right. But now you can't. They didn't cap how high you could go on a sentence. So people could,
well, theoretically, the statutory max is a cap, but...
Right. But in Clearwater, you might get 5 years for something where you would get 2 years for it in Miami. So they kind of ruined this uniformity, at least in state court, that they tried to get.
So it's basically based on the judge at this point.
Absolutely. But not the bottom. That's the thing, is they wanted to make sure judges weren't too soft. So they made sure that the judges had a bottom, but not a top.
So I guess before we go any further, let's stop for a second and talk about who actually hands out the sentences. Because I think some people are confused about that. Whether it's a plea or a trial and you get convicted, who's the person that actually decides the sentence? Is it the jury? Is it the prosecutor? Or is it the judge?
Well, that's a good question. If it's a plea deal, the state attorney actually handles the plea deal, but there is input from the victim of the crime. So if the victim does not agree, many times the judge will not accept the plea agreement that the state attorney's office has.
Okay, I'm not talking about semantics. I'm getting straight to the literal point. Who is the person that sets the sentences in all these cases?
Well, the judge does. The judge is going to issue the sentence in a particular case. Now, without going into all the details, there are recommendations that are taken from either jurors or victims, and all that stuff takes may play a role into the judge's determination, but the judge ultimately will convey the sentence.
So in non-capital cases, which means non-death penalty cases, no matter what the prosecutor says, no matter what the defense attorney says, no matter what the victim says, no matter what the jury says, the judge is the person that actually determines the sentence at the end of the day, or at least ratifies whatever the sentence is.
Right. There are the one thing we haven't covered, and I'm sure we will, is mandatory minimums.
Right.
That's a different ballgame, because even though a judge may want to give a lower sentence in a particular case, if the legislature has demanded that there be a mandatory minimum prison sentence, the judge cannot go below what the legislature said was the mandatory minimum sentence.
Okay, and the judge also can't go above the statutory cap. I'm saying right. When there's a decision to be made. Obviously, if their hands are tied by the statutes of the laws, but when there's a decision to be made about sentences, the judge is the person ultimately making that decision.
Yes.
So just, and that was just for general lay people that might not know whether a jury does it or whether a prosecutor does it or the victim picks it or whatever. Ultimately, it lies within the hands of the judges, but the legislature takes it out of the judges in certain circumstances. And that's, you know, like you were talking about, minimum mandatory sentences or statutory maxes, which we've already talked about. So I guess real quick, because I don't want to take all day on the death penalty, and we can, you know, do another death penalty podcast if we want to, but who makes the determination in a death penalty case whether or not that person is going to get the death penalty?
Well, that's interesting, because those are the most recent Supreme Court cases about the death penalty, in that Florida, always the judge made the final decision, but it's whether or not the jury had to make a majority or had to be unanimous. And now the appellate courts have said a jury has to be unanimous in their recommendation to the judge. But the judge makes that final decision.
Right. So the judge can still overturn what the jury says in that case as
yes.
well. Okay. So when we're talking about sentences, we did an entire podcast on plea deals. But I just want to touch on what are the differences in sentences when you talk about a plea deal versus a trial. We already determined that the judge is still making the final decision. But are there any differences when you're talking sentencing when you plea to something versus when you go to trial and lose?
Well, technically, the sentences are not supposed to be dictated by whether or not you exercise your constitutional right to go to trial. Practically, those decisions can have an impact on what your sentence is going to be. For example, if you decide to enter into a plea agreement with the prosecutor and the prosecutor provides the court with a specific set of facts in order to ratify a plea deal, that may be a better way to go, as opposed to having a judge hear the entirety of the evidence against you, at which point they may not like you as much and you may get a harsher sentence. And that's just an example.
And just as a side note, remember, I'll just tell your audience, when we get to federal court, federal sentence is different. But in state court, there is not a specific category for pled guilty and therefore safe time.
Taking responsibility for your actions.
Yeah,
in federal court, we'll get to that.
Yeah, in state court, it's very loose. It's up to the judge.
So my point being in state court is we talked about the numbers. We threw 44 out there. That number doesn't change if you go to trial, right?
That is correct.
So that 44 is 44 whether you plead day one or whether you lose at trial.
Yes.
But if you were to compare sentences in the cases you have, if you go to trial and lose versus you plead day one, are the sentences easier or harsher day one versus the day after trial?
There's no doubt there's a harsher sentence if you went to trial. And the reason for that sometimes is the prosecutors don't want to try the case, and they don't like the fact that you did not accept responsibility.
Basically just do what they say.
You know,
they say your guy committitted this crime.
Right.
Why are you not pleading to it? It's so obvious that he committed it.
Plus, frankly, a judge likes to hear
which is not always true. What I'm saying is, like, sometimes the prosecutors just don't want to have to prove their case, even though that's what the Constitution says.
Right. But judges like to hear remorse. They like to hear the fact that takes responsibility for the case. They like to hear that they're sorry. They like to hear them apologize to the victims. All that doesn't happen if you go to trial. Plus, if you go to trial, the victim injury may be more severe than the judge imagines when he actually sees the pictures. All sorts of things can be affected by that trial. So, yes, there's no doubt you'll get a harsher sentence if you go to trial.
And then another thing that can happen in trial that may or may not be legitimate, if the court finds that your client took the stand and testified, was convicted, and the court believes they were lying on the stand and maybe committed another crime like perjury, they could give a harsher sentence, even though it's not going to be added to the crimes that they're convicted of. that could come into play as to why they might give a harsher sentence at the end of trial if you decided to go to trial as opposed to plea. Basically, you get on the stand, you say, I didn't do it. You get convicted, which means you did it. You know, legally speaking, it means you did it. So the judge then could think you were also lying on top of whatever other crime you committed.
Another thing is that now that we have sentencing guidelines in Florida, they also did away with the parole commission. So when you are sentenced now to whatever your sentence is, your minimum mandatory, whatever it is, you go to prison, there is no longer parole that you have to serve your whole sentence. Normally it's 85%. They'll give you up to 15% is what's called gain time. But now people
for good
go
behavior,
to
basically.
Right. Now that people go to prison, they're going to serve at least 85%. And there's no longer these early outs that there used to be. So they did away with parole. A lot of people don't realize you can't be paroled anymore.
Okay, so quickly, because we want to get to the federal system. In state court, whether it's after trial or after a plea, if you plead open to the court, what can you do? What can you accomplish as a lawyer during a sentencing hearing? And what can you show the judge to try to go easy on your client, whether you went to trial or just pled open to the court?
Either way, you're as a defense lawyer, your job is to mitigate the sentence. So you provide what we call mitigating.
Meaning lessen the sentence as much as you can.
Correct. Now, realize the prosecutors many times will put out the aggravating factors that they want the court to consider. But what normally will happen is you will put together a presentation for the judge. And that presentation will encompass normally a lot of medium. Either going to have some testimony, you may have some family members or potentially the victim write a letter for you if they're obviously is friendly to you. You may have a hearing and bring in a psychologist or some learned professional, whatever that professional may be, just to give the court an indication about why the sentence for this particular person should be a lower versus a higher one.
And when you do the sentencing and you're trying to get these mitigating factors, do you still have to stay between the guidelines minimum and the statutory maximum?
You're always have to sit within the statutory maximum. The guidelines minimum, I think, can be breached. There are some things that allow the court to go below it. For example, if you're a youthful offender, there may be some statutorily prescribed things. But for the most part...
And is that something you put on at the sentencing hearing?
Yes.
Okay.
But for the most part, you're going to be stuck between that range of the statutory maximum and the guidelines minimum.
Also, it's important to note, because right now it's very relevant because of the amendment that's going to allow felony offenders to vote, is that part of your sentence is also a fine that may be imposed by the court, restitution if someone lost money based on the crime, and costs if the sheriff's office spent $2,000 investigating your case, the judge is going to put that into your sentence. So all of those factors are done at sentencing, and your lawyer has to advocate for you in order to get the fine reduced, maybe the restitution reduced, even the cost of the sheriff's office. And then lastly, don't forget that in sex cases, at the sentencing, there'll also be registered sex offender labeling or sexual predator that also happens at your sentencing.
Okay, so as we move into the federal system, explain some of the biggest differences between the state and the federal sentencing system.
Well, the federal sentencing system came about in about 1984, and it is far more complicated than the state system. A lot more factors go into it. One of the biggest areas is what's called relevant conduct. In the federal system, if you're convicted of, let's say, conspiracy to deal in drugs, but the organization you're involved with has been dealing drugs for 15 years, then all of their drug offenses for the last 15 years can affect your sentence because it's considered relevant conduct. So if you actually sold, and in federal court, the amount of drugs makes a difference on your sentence. So let's say you sold 1 kilo and that's what you were arrested for, but your organization sold 100 kilos. Well, your sentencing guideline is going to shoot up because it's going to take all the relevant conduct into effect.
Yeah, and what George is getting at for relevant conduct that some people don't actually understand is relevant conduct is not the conduct that you were charged with for the crime that you're either pleading or being sentenced for. It is the stuff around what happened.
What other people did.
Either what other people or what you may have done at a different time that you're not even charged with.
So are there, in federal court, are there minimums and maximums for each case? Are there guidelines? Are there statutory caps?
There are statutory caps, but there are also guidelines. In federal court, the guideline isn't the maximum statutory sentence. It is actually, let's say, 12 months to 34 months.
So there actually is a high and a low when you do it in federal court.
It used to be also that way. It was also decided to be mandatory. The judges had to do that unless they found some particular exceptions. But we had a case called Booker that came out about 15, 20 years ago. When Booker came out, The U.S. Supreme Court said you can't order a judge to sentence somebody between this and this. That's unconstitutional. You can recommend to the judge. So now the guidelines are truly guidelines for federal judges. They can go below or above the guideline, but generally...
But in your experience, most of the time, do they stay within that?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, they do.
Except for exceptional circumstances. And
yes, but the problem is the frequency that they've imposed or exceeded a guideline has doubled since the Booker case. So since the Booker case, they've actually gone above the guidelines.
But it's still a small percentage, but it's just twice as much.
Right. The majority of judges sentence within that guideline range, which makes it easier. So if you're talking to a client, you can tell a client, look, statistically, you're going to get between this sentence and that sentence this many months and that many months.
And usually, can't you tell, I mean, if it's particularly egregious, you can tell the client, like, this is the guideline, but because of your circumstances, there is a small percentage chance the judge goes above.
Right.
Like, and you usually know that. You're not usually shocked where you plea in court and then all of a sudden the judge goes above.
Well, that's the key to having a lawyer that knows what he's doing. They know the judge, and they know, look, we know this judge under these facts normally does not go above the guidelines.
This is like an off-topic, just very quick tangent. If that happens, can you appeal it?
If he goes above the guideline, yes, you can appeal it.
Okay.
Now, you can even appeal a guideline sentence, but a guideline sentence is presumed reasonable
by
the appellate
courts. Right, and I don't want to get into all that and how you appeal sentences, but I would think that if the judge does something that's such a small percentage that kind of shocks you, you could say, well, we wouldn't have pled if we thought that and kind of try something to appeal it. Right. Okay, so let's talk about a plea versus a trial in federal court. Is there any difference in the sentences? Does your score change? Do the sentences get worse from your experience? Same thing we did with state court.
Yeah. Federal court is just more pronounced, meaning that an election to go to trial automatically is going to make it worse for you because federal court has the concept of acceptance of responsibility.
Explain that. So let's go into what goes into sentencing important in federal court. Not in state court.
Apparently, the federal courts believe that taking responsibility for one's actions is a very important part of the rehabilitative process. In state courts, frankly, the judges for the most part care less whether you're accepted.
Does it make a big difference in federal court?
It does. It may be two or three levels.
And what does that mean when you say two or three levels?
It could wind up
How many years or months does that equate to generally?
It could relate to about 18 months, give or take, of difference between a sentence.
Which something we've talked about in other podcasts is how you sometimes get false plea deals or false confessions. It's like, well, if I can for sure save 18 months on something it looks like I'm going to get convicted on, I might as well plead to it as opposed to fight it and get worse.
Right.
Yeah. So.
There's a but, though, in federal court when it comes to pleas or trials. Normally, in federal court, you will enter into a plea agreement with the state attorney's office, with the U.S. attorney's office, excuse me. That plea agreement will kind of dictate what your general range of sentencing is going to be for the court. Now, in some districts, they actually make it binding. In some districts like ours, you cannot bind the judge. But I will tell you, all that stuff goes away if you go to trial and lose.
Or it goes away if you have the sentencing hearing and you no longer take responsibility, it could all go away as well.
Absolutely.
That's why it's such an important part in the federal system.
And in the federal system and the state system, your cooperation is figured in. Now, in the federal system, they actually have a specific section of the guideline as to when you cooperate, what's supposed to happen. Only the U.S. Attorney's Office can recommend a downward departure for your cooperation. The state system, if you cooperate, only the state attorney can do it. So no matter how good you are, no matter, you can go out, let's say you get arrested and you're facing a serious sentence, 15, 20 years, and you go out and you arrange for 50 buys of drugs that the people get arrested and go to prison for, and you come in and say, now we have cooperated, we want a reduction, and the state attorney or the U.S. attorney decides they don't want to file the motion, there's nothing you can do. You're still stuck with that 25 years. They control the reductions.
So how does cooperation then affect sentences?
Only if the state or the federal...
Right, if they agree to it, how can that affect the sentence?
Oh, a huge impact. In federal court, normally the U.S. Attorney's Office will recommend a specific downward departure. 10 levels, 15
levels. Below the guidelines even?
Right. We didn't, and I don't know if you want to get into the details of how they actually do the scoring in the federal.
Sure.
But
you mean in the pre-sentence report?
No. There's a scoring grid.
Okay, go ahead.
On the very top of the grid, it's a piece of paper. On the top, it has the number of your prior convictions. Then you go down. Your point system, again, it's a point system. You look on the point system on the left-hand column. It's where they intersect. That is where you have your score. So if they intersect at 51 to 65 months, then that's what goes to the judge. Those are levels. So if you're at level 20 and you cooperate and the government says we recommend a 10-level departure, then you go from a 20 to a 10. In that case, in federal sentencing, they have zones. But in that case, you'll be in a zone where you could actually get probation or actually get what's called a split sentence.
So a lot of this is done with charts and numbers that you can actually project and understand what might happen. None of it shouldn't be a big surprise. But when you get into certain things that are downward departures, whether it's acceptance of responsibility and cooperation, you can affect those charts and those numbers and those zones that you're actually right. in based on the crime you committed.
And once the government or the state files the motion, that leaves it up to the judge. They might recommend 10, but the judge could give you 15.
Right.
And it happens all the time where judges give a better sentence if your lawyer advocates for you, saying, look, his cooperation is worth more than 10 levels, and the judge will give 15 levels.
Levels down.
Levels down.
Right.
A reduction.
Right, right. Meaning an even better sentence for your client. So talk a little bit about the pre-sentence report phase and what goes into that and how that affects the sentence.
Well, in federal court, every case has a pre-sentence report.
And that's not the case in state court.
No, it is not. In federal court, the state doesn't have the resources to do that. But they do a report. In that report, it's your family history, your prior record, your medical history. They put the facts of the case in there. And they do a sentencing guideline score. So when the judge actually gets to your sentencing, the judge has three sentencing guideline scores. One you did as the defense lawyer. One the government did. And one the probation officer did. And then the government has to resolve all the differences that there are in those three recommended scores.
The government or the judge?
I'm sorry, the judge. Okay. I'm sorry. The judge has to resolve all the differences in those three scores.
Okay, so, and the third one, that's not the government or the defense, that's done by an actual probation officer who does interviews, including one with your client, which you authorize, and at that point the defendant is speaking.
And the probation officer gets to ex parte the judge, which is also an interesting thing.
What does that mean?
That means they can have private conversations right. with the judge that you don't hear
exactly.
about your possible sentence.
Okay, so a probation officer does all this stuff. So we talked about before in state court, at a sentencing hearing, you can have letters provided, you can have testimony, you can have a psychologist or psychiatrist come talk. Is that done in federal court in a sentencing hearing? Or is it done? It sounds like it might be done during the pre-sentence report phase.
A lot of the, I guess, the less contested stuff will happen in the pre-sentence report. But you have
meaning,
the,
do you provide the letters that you get? Which we, when we say letters, we mean, wow, this doctor was such a great doctor. They saved my life. I wouldn't have been cured of cancer without them if, you know, they've now been convicted of something. Or, you know, this person was my landlord. He was so great. He saved my life. Blah, blah, blah. Stuff like that can be presented to see the good that this person has done in the world during the pre-sentence report
right.
phase.
Right. You would actually give those letters to the probation office and they will be incorporated in the pre-sentence report right. and the judge will see them. The bigger stuff, if you're arguing now psychiatric issues or you're arguing something about, for example, whether or not a dollar amount of loss should be taken into consideration for the court, that stuff normally is done live at a sentencing hearing in front of the court.
Or if you want somebody that's got a particularly good testimony about your client, you can have that done live as
Absolutely.
Well as the pre-sentence report. I mean, yeah. at the sentencing hearing.
Right. Sometimes you try to fill the courtroom with supporters, even though only three or four people will speak, just to show the judge how much support that your client has.
So there's both phases, I guess you're saying. There's the pre-sentence report phase where that's submitted to the court along with the defense and the prosecutor's reports. And then there's still a sentencing hearing where more evidence can be put on to try to sway the judge one way or the other.
Right. And the pre-sentence report phase is a very important phase because you meet with a probation officer. You give the probation officer what you want to give them, and you try to convince the probation officer to score it like you score the sentencing guidelines.
And one of the things, the big differences between state court and federal court when it comes to those departures, in federal court, they're actually enumerated in the federal sentencing guideline. So the discussions are whether or not a particular departure, either up or down, applies to your client.
So if you were to say, if you were to compare the two, state and federal, the systems of sentencing, which do you like better and why?
I like the federal system. I like better because there's more certainty. And it's actually, I mean, the federal book is like 300 or 400 pages. But if you go through it, you have more certainty. It's not a roll of the dice. It's far more of a roll of the dice in state court. Although federal cases tend to be more serious. The sentences tend to be more serious.
But that most of the time has to do with the crime.
Yes.
There's not a DUI that's
right.
done in federal court.
For instance, in federal court.
Well, I mean, I'm saying most DUIs are done in state court, and they're not as serious as the Medicare fraud yeah. or the terrorist bombing. That all right. goes to yeah. federal court.
Another example, in state court, you have someone who stole $1 million. or embezzled $1 million. In state court, it's a roll of the dice what that sentence is going to be. In federal court, there's a score assigned to $1 million. So you'll know what the score is, and you'll know what the range is going to be.
Do you feel like you have more of an effect on state sentences or federal sentences?
It's hard to say.
As a defense attorney.
You have more of an effect on the technical aspects of the sentence, but in state court, because there's no...
In federal court,
but in state court, it's such a roll of the dice that because the judge can go all over the place, you might have more effect in state court because he doesn't have the same guideline restrictions.
Yeah, I'm kind of a leaning with George on I like the federal system better because I can take the book out, do the calculation, and I know where we're going to be within up or down range. But in state court, you can get so much more accomplished just because the...
There are benefits and negatives.
Yeah, there are benefits.
Okay, right. And that makes sense. And one of the reasons the state isn't set up like the federal court is because of the funding.
Oh, absolutely. And the volume. I mean, you have a tenth of the cases in federal court that you have in a state court.
That makes sense. So, all right, hopefully everybody learned something today. Give us a follow. Give us a subscription on iTunes or SoundCloud or wherever you listen. We'll be back with you guys next time.
You've been listening to Peter's Proffer with Clearwater attorney Peter Trakos. The experienced lawyers at Trakos, Sartes, and Trakos discuss common legal questions, providing insight into the legal process and covering current events as they relate to the legal field. Find out more at TrakosLaw.com.